If you were to take a panoramic view of the church in North America over, say, the past decade, the scene might not look so pretty. A church south of the borders become hardly recognizable. And yet for years, I suppose, it all felt a bit distant, perhaps, for us up here. Whatever was going on down there with their weird political allegiances, it was like, it's a USA problem. But then COVID hit, and suddenly the woes of the church felt much closer to home. It started with the intense media spotlight on Trinity Bible Church, a church barely 15 minutes from here, with their fierce Christian nationalistic rhetoric and resistance to any government COVID measures. And then, of course, there's the ongoing saga, the scandal at the meeting house around their celebrity pastor and what seems to be a culture of cover-up. And then together, suddenly, the worst of the church seemed to land right in our backyard. Morally failed leaders, sexual abuse, lawsuits, NDAs, congregations sucked into ugly politics. A slew of books have come out showcasing the overt racism and misogyny that's baked into many of our Christian traditions. And you can't help but asking, why does this keep happening? And I think it's well beyond the point of thinking this is just about a few bad apples. It would seem there's something deeply entrenched in the church in North America that keeps leading to scandalous and harmful failings. Why? What is happening? Well, it seems to me that an examination of how and why churches and pastors go bad, so to speak, seems like a worthwhile examination, and so I want to do a three-week series here. And I suppose there's many ways of looking at the problem, but I would posit that all of this stems, at least initially, from an unhealthy relationship to power. And I think we're going to understand the problems facing the church. If we're going to avoid the pitfalls of failed churches and pastors, I think it means examining power. How does it work? So let me confess up front, this makes me nervous. It's always an uncomfortable thing to examine power when you have it. And in our current climate, I don't blame the average person of faith for being skeptical and cynical about church. I mean, if it can happen to Bill Hybels, if it can happen to Ravi Zacharias, if it can happen to Bruxy Cavey, well, then what pastor might it not happen to? And it isn't a wrong assumption. Power has a corrosive effect on the people who have it. And this is why maybe spending the next 3 weeks watching Lord of the Rings films would be good. It's a great tale. And it reminds us only the most humble and unassuming can be trusted with power. The wisest and strongest know not to have too much power because of the temptations it brings. And it's only the foolish who believe they possess enough character to do good with power. It's more than fantasy, it's a warning, a stern warning. Even still, I can't help but when survey the church landscape to see all the moral failings of the church, from clergy sexual abuse to dangerous political alliances, I can't help but think that it stems from a distortion and misunderstanding. The church continues to believe that God's power works in the same way as worldly power. Now, the good news, or bad news, depending on how you look at it, is that this distortion and misunderstanding has been baked into the mix from the very beginning. In the Gospels, we frequently find Jesus' followers jockeying and vying for power. In one instance, they ask Jesus, should we call down fire on these people who aren't listening to us? It's like they're playing the role of Mark Driscoll. Should we just run them over with the bus? She's like, whoa, calm down. And in other stories, we find the disciples, they're really, really paying attention to where they fit in the hierarchy. Where are we? Jesus is at top, okay, we get that, but we want to be right next to him. And at one point, James and John, they pull a bold move, and they just straight up ask Jesus, hey, when you become king, can we be on your right and your left? And of course, the other disciples are like, oh, what are you doing? No, we want to be on the right and left. And so there's an argument among them, and then Jesus has to step in, and he says some very powerful words about power, gives us a different vision of power. Mark 10, he says, you know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it's not so among you. But whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be a slave of all. The passage to me outlines two very radically different views of power. Jesus explains the way power is typically used, a power over others. And then he gives us a vision of a different type of power, a power among others. And I want to briefly this morning look at those two powers. But I think the heart of what Jesus is saying here is practicing power over others has no place in Jesus' kingdom or church. Pursuing or practicing power over others is a power that's absent of God. And the power of God is unleashed when we are among one another. And yet, 2,000 years later, we're still wrestling with this. And again, be it from clergy sexual abuse or dangerous political alliances, the trouble with church and many of its leaders is we're lured by the neon lights of pursuing power over others. And I want to explore what that looks like. The first thing I think to say about power is this: power is present in almost every social situation. Power exists, it's everywhere, it's in so many of our daily interactions. It can work for good or ill, it can be used to help people live or flourish, it can wreak enormous harm on people's lives, but it's everywhere. Consider the power of position. Just call a spade, I have power right now, and if you were a Tampa Bay Lightning fan, you would be like, he just pulled a power move by celebrating the Leafs win. The person with the microphone has power. Certain positions have power. There's the power of talent. I've played a little bit of Ultimate Frisbee with the Nexus folk here. And I do not have the power of talent. And it's interesting because when you play Frisbee, I still like to try to give motivational speeches, even though I'm awful. I'm out of breath. Hey, guys, I think maybe if we passed a little more, we'd be good. But someone like a JD shows up, and he's good. And when he says something, people listen because he has talent, and you follow people with talent. Power of personality. Some people are charming. I have a friend, a professor of literature, and his vocabulary is so charming to me because he uses all these big words from big books, and I want to listen and follow him because he's got such charming personality. There's the power of knowledge. You ever get one of those emails? Say to you, hey, there's some things on my mind. I'd like to meet with you. It's like, oh boy. I'm going to meet with you, but you know what we're talking about. I don't know what we're talking about. So I'm showing up powerless. You've had weeks to run in your head what we're going to talk about. I have no power right now. Power of attraction, right? Study after study. Attractive people get better tips. We're lured by the power of attraction. Power of impression. Kristen doesn't like any time I go to the mall alone because I get myself into trouble. And one Christmas, I'm wandering around a mall, and this guy says, wow, look at your shirt. It's so wrinkly. I'm like, Oh, yeah. It's like, I got to show you my steam cleaner, portable steam cleaner. I've never ironed a shirt or pants in my life. I don't really care about wrinkles, but he brought me in, and he showed me, did this, you know, made this shirt wrinkle-free in like 30 seconds. You need this. I was like, I do. I do need that. It's like, I bought two. That's how persuasive this guy was. And because like, you will never use that. I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course I will. I used it once, showed her. Never used it again. But this person was so persuasive, they had a power over me. That's power is everywhere. So many different dynamics. Power exists and it plays into so many of our social actions. It's always there, it's always influencing us. But when power moves as simply a force of influence, into something that works over and against us, as Jesus points to, becomes a problem. Power over others needs to be defined. Max Weber, I believe it's pronounced, 19th century sociologist, he defines this power dynamic this way: the probability that one actor within a social relationship will be in a position to carry out his own will despite resistance. Resistance is key there. Having influence and exerting power over people, different shades of power when we get people to do things they don't want to do. Robert Dahl describes it this way: A has power over B to the extent that he can get B to do something that B would not otherwise do. Both point to a specific type of power, getting somebody to do something they normally wouldn't. I'm sure you've experienced this in the checkout line. I was at the LCBO the other day, and there was a long line, and they were asking people, do you want to give to trees? That was their pitch. It was really planting trees. And it's good to be generous. I get that. I hate the checkout line. But the person in front of me didn't help me because they gave $10 right in front of me. And the sales guy acted like it was the biggest deal in the world. Oh, you're so generous. Thanks for helping with the trees. And then I come up, there's people behind me. You want to give? No, but I will. Power of impression. I don't want to look bad. And so there's a power over that exists. And we see this, you know, all the way from wars to board meetings. Power over others. And this is the most recognizable form of power. Get people to do things they wouldn't normally do. And it can go wrong so many ways. This is the type of power that confuses someone into sexual activity, even though they don't want it. This is the kind of power that prompts normally law-abiding citizens to civil disobedience. It's the power behind every single war, every act of violence. And yet, even though we see this kind of power play out in extreme outcomes, it's a power that exists in boardrooms, checkout counters, when you feel obliged to give to charity. Chances are, if we're honest with ourselves, we've all been both a victim and a perpetrator of this type of power. It's fairly easy to recognize, and recognizing that over the past 100 years, it was like, what do we do about this power dynamic? And feminism, following World War II, made a big leap in helping us think about power. Second and third wave feminism started to emphasize the distribution of power as a means to accomplish justice. Thinking went, some people have power, others don't. So the solution, it was thought, was just let's merely redistribute it. And if we can redistribute power, then there would be more equality between men and women and marriage partners and persons of color and white persons. It could go a long way in helping the marginalized if we redistribute power, and it certainly does, at least to a point. There are things that we can redistribute. We see this most clearly right now in the war in Russia. You've got a powerful country invades a less powerful country. There's a power dynamic there. So what does the West do? We're going to redistribute power. We're going to back Ukraine, make it a bit more of a fair fight, so to speak. Or corporations, we're going to try to make sure we have a quota for hiring certain marginalized groups of people. So redistribute power. It was a step forward, but it only gets you so far because the ultimate power question cannot be ignored. Who gets to decide the just distribution of power? And whoever that is still has a lot of power. And so within feminism, voices started to emerge and saying, there's a bit of a flaw with this. Iris Marion Young, for instance, argued that bringing power under the logic of distribution misconstrues what power is. Power is a relation rather than a thing. The systemic. Moving things around accomplishes very little if the systems the power is baked into don't change themselves. The cultural theorist, you probably have heard of him, Slavoj Zizek, yeah. You probably know him because if you've seen a video of him, he always talks and then says, and so on and so on. We're talking about power and so on and so on. Anyway, he does that like at the end of every sentence. But he makes a distinction between subjective power and objective power. Subjective power happens when a person inflicts a violent act against another person, harms their well-being, a burglary, for instance, a terrorist act, domestic violence. All of those are subjective violence, but objective violence has no clear perpetrator because it's the violence woven into the system, the way the system works. How is someone encouraged to commit an act of violence? Critical race theory has been wrestling through this. For instance, might racism be written into our legal system? Are the rules, justification, ways of doing things that are built into a system that exploit one group over another? And so we see this in the headlines, but miss the objective power. It's like, okay, a cop shoots a black man, that gets the headlines. Or there's gang violence in school, that gets the headlines. But objective power considers, whoa, what is the system that breeds these kind of acts? Let's use an easy one here, because sort of understand this. We might say, okay, we need to stop racist acts by police officers. So one way, let's make sure they get, you know, some training in equity, diversity, and inclusion. That way, maybe it'll redistribute power. But Willie Jennings is brilliant in pointing out, whoa, that's not so simple. He points out this, take a look at what basic training looks like for state and local police. So you can give somebody training, but when most of your time baked into the system is spent training with firearms, you might have police shooting more. When all the emphasis is on firearm skills, self-defense, health and fitness, and those other things way down there, it's like the system promotes a certain way of police officers being. But this isn't a sermon on police and power. It's a sermon on church and power. But I bring all this up simply to say this. The continued revealing of pastors sexually abusing parishioners or pastors leading congregations into ugly political allegiances, it's not going to be dealt with by just addressing a single abusive actor or narcissistic pastor. And it's not good enough to just say, well, we got to put some guardrails up, practices to keep the pastor in line. In fact, some of those practices are harmful. What often happens is they call it the Billy Graham rule. Billy Graham rule is no pastor shall ever meet alone with a woman. That way, you won't mess up. But the unintended consequence is just further power imbalance. If a woman can never talk to a pastor, how are women heard in the church? Where some will say, well, belong to a denomination. That way, you've got a governing body over you. Really? That's helped? I mean, the continued failing pastors and churches and denominations is not going to be dealt with just by dealing with a single abusive actor or narcissistic pastor, because I think what's been revealed to us in the last few years is this, is there is woven within the church system a power over dynamic. It's baked into the mix. It's being revealed to us and it needs to be reshaped. How so? Well, let's look again at Jesus' teaching on power. Jesus exposes the power over dynamics so often at work in individuals and system, but Jesus alludes to something else here. You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them, but it's not so among you. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you must be a slave of all. Jesus alludes to a different kind of power. Different kind of power than the power over. This way of power is starkly different. It's a power that refuses the power over position. Instead, it's a power among and with. And this power is a power of relationship, unleashed when you're with people. It's the power that's released in the mutuality between people. And this power can get things done. It just does things differently. And I know some of us might be skeptical, really a different kind of power. But here's the thing that I've noticed in reading over the years is so many different people from different walks of life talk about this kind of power. And so many of them talk about it, it's impossible to deny it exists. Let's consider a few. Martin Luther King Jr., perhaps the most prominent advocate of power with people. He called it the power of nonviolence. And it was a power released as we engage injustice through relationship, person-to-person presence, people-to-people encounter. The pioneering queer theorist, Judith Butler, she argues for what she calls the core feature of human existence is interdependency and vulnerability. And for her, relationality was a condition of a thriving human life. Mahatma Gandhi called this a soul force as opposed to a brute force. And it's released when there's power among the people, and he said it's 1,000 times more effective than power over. Gustavo Gutierrez, the Latin American liberation theologian, called this the power of the poor. Absent the power over dynamic of riches, there's a power unleashed with those who don't have power over. Black liberation theologian James Cone speaks about this as well, called the liberating power of the black experience. Divine presence, he said, is revealed in the lives of the poor where there's not a power dynamic. Queer novelist Sarah Schulman, in her book Conflict is Not Abuse, she talks about how power works. Conflict is healthy. Abuse is power over. Conflict is when we're truly with each other, and it's normal and healthy. Discerning the difference for her between power over and power with is paramount. And here's the thing, all of these thinkers, they come from many different shades of life, many different perspectives, and they use different language to talk about it, but they all bear testimony to a power, a different kind of power. It's a power that is released via personal embodied presence, relationality, love, and mutuality. Those four things. It's impossible to deny that this kind of power exists. And according to Jesus, to exercise power over others is antithetical to the Jesus path. It's to use a power that works independently of God, but Jesus showcases a different kind of power. It exists when we're truly among one another. But it requires some things from me and from us. It requires presence, relationality, love, mutuality. And when that happens within a community, a different kind of power is unleashed. David Fitch says this, if one of the great arguments of the 20th century is that the church has been on the wrong side of history when it comes to slavery, the oppression of women, poverty, sexuality, I ask whether it has been on the wrong side of power in all these instances. I then noticed that whenever the church was among the oppressed, or giving up worldly power, or making space for godly power in Christ, soon thereafter, abolitionist movements, women's suffrage movements, workers' movements, ministries to overcoming poverty ensued. Whenever the church aligned with worldly power, it either limited its work for the kingdom or outright compromised it in the most hideous of ways. When churches or pastors start vying for power over worldly kind of power we're familiar with, it unleashes the worst of the church. But I believe when we commit to eschewing that kind of power, we place ourselves in a better position. And in that place, there's a power that's released via personal embodied presence, relationality, love, mutuality. What does that mean for me and you? Give us an analogy. My dog's awful. And walking it is horrendous, and I can't get it to ever just walk like a nice dog beside me. And I've got all the lessons from people. In fact, I can't believe I was walking down the street. Someone said, what you need to do is get a wooden spoon, cover it in peanut butter, and then when you're walking your dog, every 10 seconds, you just put it down so it can lick it, and that way it will learn to stay beside you. And so I'm walking like a maniac down the street with peanut butter on a wooden spoon, and still my dog just awful, running around all the time. The only thing that works is to keep it on a short leash. I got a leash, handle right here, doesn't have any room to work with. You can't go anywhere because you're forced to be there. I think there's some things that pastors and churches should be on short leashes for. So what does this mean for me? Well, personal embodied presence. I got to show up. And from day one here, Murray and I have held to a principle that we can never lose. And that's this: we're available. Because the moment a pastor becomes unavailable and starts removing themselves from the life of a community, from the day-to-day life, that's a problem. If a pastor ever gets too big for their britches, I don't got time because I'm doing important Lord's work, that's a problem. Has to be embodied presence. And sometimes that means me playing on a Frisbee team that I have no business playing on, Soup Sunday, whatever it is. Pastors, staff at churches, they have to show up. And the moment they don't, that's a big problem. And the moment I don't, yank the leash. This second one's a bit awkward. Relationality, not brand building. This is really awkward because I have a book coming out in about a month, and I really need your help, so I'm not swimming in debt trying to get this thing to see the light of day. I could use your help a little there, but when pastors become brands instead of pastors, that's a problem. And this is where I would say the systemic comes in. This is a systemic problem in the church because we love celebrity Christians. We love putting them on pedestals. And everywhere within the system is pressure for pastors saying, your measure of success is how big your brand is and how many followers you have and how many people are listening and tuning in. Everything else can feel sort of worthless, and it's a huge problem. Pastors and churches are not brands, we're communities. And the moment you start seeing a pastor spend all their time on social media talking with people who aren't in their congregation, it's a problem. And yet we love it. Some of my favorite Christian authors, that's what they are. They're the brand, and I love them, and they think well, but it's a systemic problem that we go, pastors are not just pastors. They're supposed to be a brand. But we're not. And we shouldn't be. So if it ever comes, you're on Facebook one day, be like, oh, Brad's been chatting it up all day. Yank the leash. Brad, get off social media. Stop talking to people who aren't part of the congregation. That's not where you belong. You're not a brand. Third, love. With this community, I will be patient, kind. These next ones I got a bit of work to do on. Not envy or boast, not be proud, will not dishonor others, won't be self-seeking or easily angered, and will keep no record of wrongs. I had a little talk with God about this week. I said, God, I cannot promise this when it comes to hockey. And I cannot promise this when it comes to traffic, but for this community, I will be patient, I will be kind, I will not envy, I will not boast, I will not be proud, will not dishonor others, won't be self-seeking or easily angered, and keep no records of wrongs. That's a tall order. I'm trying, but that's got to be the commitment. And then last, mutuality, listening, learning, submitting. I had a meeting with, I don't know if they're here this morning, a meeting with someone. They didn't like the surveys we sent out recently. Fair enough. Why are you asking about summer, Brad? You know, you're not going to see me over the summer, this person said. You won't see me. Why are we even asking the question? You know that's what Nexus does over the summer. We slow down, not shut down, slow down. Why are we even asking the question? Because if we don't ask the question, it showcases a leadership that's not listening. I like summers the way they are, but the moment you stop listening or learning or trying to submit to the community, mutual submission, it's a huge problem. Well, the sexual ethics survey. I know some people are like, what are you doing with this? It's like trying to listen, trying to learn, trying to mutually submit to each other, because I don't ever want Nexus to be a place where it's top down, speak some sort of truth, everybody got to listen. No, there has to be a mutuality in a community of listening, learning. And in that, you'd learn some interesting things. For instance, we got Soup Sunday this morning. And in various labs and whatnot we've done this year, I've learned that Soup Sunday is very uncomfortable for some people. And I didn't know that. I thought Soup Sunday was our greatest invention. Mutuality, eating soup together. But in the course of running these things, I've heard for some people who don't know others or don't have a family, it could be very uncomfortable to try to make small talk. So this is my public service announcement. If you see someone that doesn't have anyone to talk to them. But the only way you learn stuff like that is by listening and by trying to hear from people. So that's what it means for me, at least, to start. What does it mean for you? Personal embodied presence. Show up. Because we can't do community relationships when we're apart. And it's relationality, not consumerism. One of the things that happens in the system of pastors is when it becomes just about receiving a religious good and service. I come here, or maybe I listen in, and I take it in, and that's all it is. It's like that just inflates pastors' egos. I'm the thing that people want to hear, and it just inflates it, and so it can't be just about consuming at church. It's got to be about relationality. And then I'll ask the same thing from you. Love this community. Just start right here. Again, doesn't have to maybe apply everywhere to start, but with this community, I will be patient, kind, not envy, not boast, not be proud, will not dishonor others, won't be self-seeking or easily angered, and will keep no record of wrongs. I'll try that with this here. And then mutuality, listening, learning from one another. Mutual submission, Paul talks about. And we hate that word submission, but it's simply, I submit this to you, and you submit to me, and I'm listening, and I'm learning. That's it. For now, we'll talk 2 more weeks on power. There's other things to talk about and expose, and it's not that easy. But with the slew of problems we see in the church, there's dangers for me, for us. We have to push back against a system that I think makes power over so tempting and alluring.